the rule of the sacrament. And so then after the basic ones, then is the brahmacharya ashram. So then topic three is the ordinances of studentship. 3.1. Having performed the rite of initiation, the teacher must first instruct the pupil in the rules of personal purification, of conduct, of fire worship, and of the twilight devotions. So then, these are the aspects that are, we see that are theirs. First, they have to know how to be pure. If they're pure, then they can behave properly. If they can behave properly, then they can perform the fire worship and the mantras that go with it. Right? Because then you can do puja, you can do these kind of ritual. Does that make some sense? So if this purity, if you have purity, then there'll be purity in conduct. Conduct is pure, then you can perform these ritualistic duties. Does that make some sense? Because all these things are dependent upon the mode of goodness. Chanting of Gayatri, performance of the puja, all these things, they have an aspect that requires the mode of goodness as a minimum platform. And but that's the glory of the holy name, is it doesn't require that. You get benefit from chanting the holy name even if one's not on that platform. These other ones, you get the most benefit when you're on that platform. When you're below that platform, then the benefit will be greatly restricted. But for the chanting, that's the wonderfulness, it doesn't matter. So that's why it's the most important of all the samskaras, actually. But on the material platform, since that is, you know, important to the conditioned living entity, then these things are considered, but one must know what it is that makes it work. So here it is, we see is that purity and purity of conduct. Yeah, well, it'd be the body, the mind, the words, all these things. Just how to keep oneself pure, like that. Details will come up as we go. Most will be with the body. But it'll also be, you know, how to keep the mind pure, austerity, performance of duties, all non-violence. You know, the same typical points will always come. We mentioned before, we opened on the, how do you say, I think at the very end. Is that it? No, this one doesn't have the end. Yeah, this one doesn't have the end. The last verses, then it says the tenfold duties. I think it's on the last page. We handed out the last page first. Huh? You don't have it, do you? Are there a whole bunch of those? You don't know. Okay, so then we'll have to get those. Okay. So a brahmana learned in the Veda who recites during both twilights that syllable and that verse preceded by the vyahrutis gains the whole merit which is which the recitation of the Veda confirms. So both twilights means the morning and evening. That doesn't mean the Gayatri is not chanted at noon. It just means the full ritual of calling, invoking the mantra, performing all the preliminary rituals, the post-rituals and all that. That's done in the morning and evening because the time is there. During the day, one is busy with duties and that one may or may not have time. So sometimes I've heard of devotees reading this in other places, like in the Bhagavatam, they'll talk about the morning and evening. And then they make the mistake that you only have to chant Gayatri twice. Even though the Acharya has given it three times, they think, oh, I'm smarter than that, and the scriptures say. The scriptures meaning that the twilight devotions, those ones, then it's expected that someone who's following, you know, on the Vedic platform, that this is their main sadhana, that they will be chanting the full ritual, which takes about 20 minutes, like that. You know, the calling, the mantra, the purification, so many mantras are there. It's a very lengthy process. So then they have to do that morning and evening. And then at noontime, then just like we do, you just sit down, chant Gayatri, and that's all. Yeah. So because chanting the holy name is our main sadhana, so we don't worry about this Vedic aspect of so much elaboration. With that, because the holy name already takes care of that purification. But the point being made here is that one who chants the Gayatri, then he gets the benefit of one chanting the whole Veda. Because from Om, then you get the Vyaharatis. From Vyaharatis, then you get the Brahma Gayatri. From the Brahma Gayatri, you get Purusha Shukta. From Purusha Shukta, you get the whole Veda. So they're all expanded from Om and from the Brahma Gayatri. That's why if you are chanting the Brahma Gayatri, then you get the benefit of the whole Veda. Now, the Omkara, that's only a partial manifestation, right? Because it's a impersonal form of Krishna. So then, let alone the names. So when you chant the holy names, you get even more. So in other words, from this you can understand the point of this section is one who chants the holy name, he gets the benefit of having studied or chanted the whole Veda. Does that make sense? So here is the Vedic point where that's the most important. So we can see by this language, it mentions here, undoubtedly a Brahmin reaches the highest goal by muttering prayers only. Whether he performs other rites or not, he who befriends all creatures is declared to be a true Brahmin. Right? So he who is kind to all, that means he has to have given up material desire. Right? Because you only, due to duality, then you will behave not nicely with other living entities because you have something to gain. You know, so anger, frustration, desire, attachment, these things, envy, covetousness, these will create violence. Right? Because when you're frustrated, then there's violence. If there's no frustration, there's no violence. And frustration won't come if there's no desire. Right? So one who is free of desire and who chants the holy name, then he's a true Brahmin. Right? So this means actually devotee. So this section here is actually pointing out the Vaishnava is the true Brahmin, and one who chants the holy name, he gets the benefit of all the Vedic literature and rites. Does that make sense?
Excuse me, what does it mean, Vyahriti?
Vyahriti is a Bhur Bhuvaswa. Oh. Vyahriti means the planetary systems. Mm-hmm. Like that. So these are the Mahavyaharitis. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So we can see is here, it's saying that the devotee who chants the holy name is the highest. But it's indirect, right? From reading this normally, you wouldn't take it that that's what this means. You would just go that, oh, okay, then it's, you know, chanting the Gayatri is important, or, you know, being peaceful or nice to everybody is important. But the only one who actually can befriend all creatures is the devotee, like that.
In our society, we have a little bit different system. Like at first, we get Harinam initiation, and second is Gayatri. And so sometimes we think that Gayatri initiation means some kind of elevation. So when one becomes advanced in chanting the holy name, so he is fit, qualified to get second initiation. But according to what you just described, means holy name in any case is the topmost activity, spiritual activity. So what is the benefit which one gets from the chanting Gayatri in this regard?
See, the Gayatri will go up to liberation. After liberation, then the Gayatri doesn't go beyond. Not the Brahma Gayatri. Kama Gayatri, and not Brahma Gayatri. So that means, you see, is that the name is there in the beginning, the name is there at the end, and the name is also there in the middle. So only the Gayatri, the Brahma Gayatri, is there in the middle. It's not there at the beginning or at the end. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So the point comes is that it looks like it's a step up. What it means is that by the process of chanting the holy name, one's come to the platform of goodness, and one is stable. And in that steady platform, then one can actually take benefit from the Vedic and Pancharatric rites. Because of their being applied on the conditioned platform, they only work with the conditioned platform is in the mode of goodness. Right? Mm-hmm. It means as a process of elevation. Does that make sense? So they won't work on somebody who's below that, but the holy name will. So the holy name elevates you to that platform. Then through that you engage your conditioned nature. See, because basically, before second initiation, people aren't necessarily very aware of their conditioned nature. They identify with it so much, they don't see that it exists. They can't separate themselves from it. So when you can separate yourself from your conditioned nature and observe it, though you still act within it, and by habit you will do so many things with it, that's when you can dynamically progress, by meaning to remove the conditioned nature. And you dynamically progress in the chanting, because then the attachments become more balanced, more less and more in control. Does that make any sense? Because otherwise, if one's too caught up in if one's identity, then progress is very slow. Right? That doesn't mean that it's ignored. That's many times, that's an immature platform, is that, oh, we don't care for this because, you know, we're not the body. That's okay, but you still have to feed the body. The body has to sleep. You know, if they're married, they're having their children, they have to defend or take care of what they have. So then we may say we chant the holy name, we don't care about this, but we're still engaged in the animal pursuits. And we're still engaged in dharma, artha, kama, and moksha of other, you know, human beings. The difference being is that now it's connected to Krishna. Right? And before that, then we were just performing the animal activities. So, yeah, so that's the position. So it has to be understood is that the holy name elevates us to the point where we can actually deal with our conditioned nature, because otherwise we can't, we're too absorbed in it. Until you can separate yourself from your conditioned nature, you can't really understand how to engage it. How do you know what it is? You know, unless you know what something is, you don't know how to engage it. Unless you can identify that the tool you have in your hand is a spoon, how do you know what to do with it? Right? If you can't discriminate between a spoon and a hammer, then it will be difficult. You try to, you know, I mean, have you ever tried to put any nails in with a spoon, or try to, you know, drink your soup with a hammer? You know, I mean, it just doesn't work. So that's the whole thing. Until you've identified it, no. But in the beginning, you don't. You so much are it that it's hard to identify. So even though you may identify it to some degree, you'll be acting on its inspiration. You know what I'm saying? In other words, in the beginning, sakam means that the inspiration is coming from the body, then you engage that desire in the Lord's service. While nishkam means you want to engage in service and you engage your conditioned nature, therefore, as the medium. Does that make sense? It's basically the same thing, but it's coming in from the opposite angle. Does that make sense?
Like that. So here we can see is that whatever rites and all that are mentioned, then if one chants the holy name exclusively, other rites aren't important. But to that degree one is engaged in other material activities, then those rites become more importance. And if one is less interested, it's not. So here's also then another verse that says that, backs this up. It says, a Brahman who completely governs himself, though he knows the Savitri only, is better than he who knows the three Vedas, but does not control himself, eats all sorts of food, and sells all sorts of goods. So in other words, for a Brahman, you have knowledge and you have character, but of the two, character is more important. Because from character and purity, then you'll get knowledge. Right? Because real knowledge is realization. Right? So the only purpose of cultivating knowledge is to get realization. You perform an activity with knowledge, and that will lead to realization. But if you chant the holy name and you perform your activities, you will also get realization. Right? This does not mean that knowledge shouldn't be learned. To that degree that one has the ability to learn, one should learn. Someone has more of an academic ability, they should engage it. Someone has less of an academic ability, don't worry about it. Whatever whatever one has, one engages that. Does that make some sense? So the character is the most important part of training. Human life, the character is the most important. Of course, nowadays, the emphasis is always put on the academic side. But the Vedic is on the character side. Because the point is you may have somebody who is greatly learned, but if he doesn't have good character, no one wants to work with the person. But if someone has a good character, then everybody will like to work with them. And they'll train them in whatever they're lacking. You know what I'm saying? It means if someone has intelligence but no character, no one's interested to teach them the character. But if someone has character but doesn't have knowledge, people are interested to teach them the knowledge. Does that make sense? So of the two, that's the most important. That's why you always see is the ashram aspect is the most prominent. Therefore, brahmachari ashram is functioning there. They're not functioning within varna at this point. Varna comes later with grihastha. Right? It's just automatically set. They do brahminical duties. Right? It means a brahmachari, doesn't matter if he's a brahmin, kshatriya, or vaishya, still performs the same duties. It's still the brahminical duties. And a vanaprast and sannyas, doesn't matter if they're brahmin, kshatriya, or vaishya, they still perform the same duties. So only in grihastha ashram does the consideration of brahmin, kshatriya, vaishya, shudra actually come into consideration. You know, in a serious way. You know, in a minor way, you deal in the other ashrams, because you know that how to best situate the person. You know, what kind of ways they would be most satisfied, or what way to communicate. Like if you're talking to a Vaishya Brahmachari, you'll communicate different than to a Brahmin Brahmachari. But the point is the character and all that has to be learned, the knowledge has to be learned. You know, for the Brahmin, it's just, you know, this is the proper thing, it's the scriptures, it's the, you know, you'll see the benefits, you know, of the spiritual elevation and all that. Kshatriya, then you'll explain to them how it'll be useful for them, you know, in the way of their administration and in the future for when they actually are practically doing service. When they're practically doing service, this knowledge and character will be very useful. For the Vaishya, then it's the gain. You know, if you don't have this, then how are you going to gain? How are you going to get business? If you don't have self-control, you're not going to be able to do business. Like that. So in any case, it's a slight thing that you use. But the activities that you see them do are the same. Right, so the activities of the brahmachari, activities of the vanaprastha, the sannyasa, the same. Right, both because their ashram and their varna are not different. All of them live by begging, or by, you know, gleaning, or like that. They all live by brahminical occupational duties. So you don't separate it. But in grihastha ashram, then they perform the ashram duties of that's brahminical, but the varna duties, then that would be separate. You know what I'm saying? Everybody's going to study, everyone is going to do sacrifice, everyone's going to give in charity. But as an occupation, then they're not necessarily going to beg or this, they're going to take tax, or they're going to do business, they're going to do farming, they're going to work for someone else, they're going like that. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So then, yeah. Yeah, so I guess that could be a third point than would be there in this section, is that the character is more important than the knowledge. Of the two, the character is the most important. Therefore, someone who has the holy name and character then is well situated. Okay, now subduing the senses. A wise man should strive to restrain his organs, which run wild amongst alluring sensual objects, like a charioteer his horses. Through the attachment of his organs to sensual pleasure, a man doubtlessly will incur a guilt, but if he keeps them under complete control, he will obtain success in gaining all his aims. Desire is never extinguished by the enjoyment of desired objects. It only grows stronger, like fire fed with clarified butter. If one man should obtain all those sensual objects and another should renounce them all, the renunciation of all pleasure is far better than the attainment of them. Those organs which are strongly attached to sensual pleasures cannot be so effectively
restrained by abstinence from enjoyments as by a constant pursuit of true knowledge. That man may be considered to have already subdued his organs, who on hearing and touching and seeing, on tasting and smelling anything, neither rejoices nor repines. But when one among all the organs slips away from control, thereby man's wisdom slips away from him, even as the water flows through the one open foot of a water carrier's skin. If he keeps all the 10 organs as well as the mind in subjugation, he may gain all his aims without reducing his body by the practice of yoga. Let an Aryan who has been initiated daily offer fuel to the sacred fire, beg food, sleep on the ground, and do what is beneficial to his teacher, till he performs the ceremony of Samvartana on returning home. Okay, so that's the next thing, is control of the senses. So it's basically meaning that unless you control the senses, you're not going to gain your aims, because if the senses are running wild, you can't actually get done what you want to do. Even if your goal is sense gratification, if your senses aren't controlled, you can't get sense gratification. That's the real fun thing. Even you're dedicated to sense gratification, you can't get it unless you control your senses. You know, it's just like, let's say you want to eat something. Now, if you don't have any controlled senses, then you're going to have to be able to get something to eat in a very minimal time. Right? So that means that there's going to be compromise. But if you can control the senses, then you have the time to prepare something very elaborate or to go to great difficulty, obtain very nice ingredients by which you can make something of a very refined nature. Does that make sense? Because the higher, more developed and refined the sense gratification, the more control is necessary to get the objects and to prepare it. Right? And the more, it's just like, fast foods. Fast foods are not known for being high grade. Right? Because that's the point, they're fast. So, but things that take more time, they're always considered better. Does that make sense? So even in sense gratification, without controlling the senses, you can't get sense gratification. You know, the less control, the more meager the sense gratification. The more control, the greater the sense gratification.
It's a good encouragement, even just like as an allurement, so that then later down the track, then you give up the whole idea of trying.
Yeah, because that's the whole point, is because you control the senses, then you get. But as soon as you start to get, then you start to, get attracted to it, so you go into it. As soon as you go into it, then it starts to fade. So when you pull back the senses, then it comes again. Right? So then the whole point is then you start to see is that you can't have both. You can't have the sense control and the sense objects. Right? When you have sense control, the sense objects come. When you give up the sense control, go for the sense object goes away. Right? So the only thing that's stable actually is sense control. That you can always have. You know what I'm saying? But senses, sense objects, you can't have. As soon as you go for them, they go away. And as soon as you're not trying to get them, they come. Right? So in a sense-controlled position, they come or not, it doesn't matter. Therefore, this last verse. That man may be considered to have really subdued his organs, who on hearing and touching and seeing, on tasting, smelling anything, neither rejoices nor repines. Senses will come. Sense objects will come, but he's not in ecstasy or in lamentation over it. So it's just whatever comes, comes. And it's just, it's just, how you say, one engages with it, but when it's not, it is not done for the purpose of sense gratification. So the senses means there will be some experiences there, but if one is trying to gain that experience, one can't have it. So that's the illusory nature. So controlling the senses is actually the point. So whatever he wants to gain, he can gain by sense control. And then, because of that sense control, he gain it, but then he'll see as you lose it as soon as you then give up the sense control. Therefore, with time, therefore you just stick to sense control and give up the idea of trying to gain something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so that's why engaging the senses still has to be done under the platform of sense control. Because if the senses aren't controlled, you won't get it anyway. Does that make sense? That's the platform. So then with time, then you start to see, well, the only stable thing is sense control. Because you can't enjoy the senses anyway, they're illusory. As soon as you try to grab them, they disappear. You know, because you're dealing with them, they don't give anything. You know, it's like, you know, there you take the first bite, very nice, you get all the full tastes and everything. But by the end of the meal, you're stuffed. Actually, you're not tasting anything. But still, there's the idea to enjoy, so one keeps eating. You know? But actually, if you think about it, you're not actually getting any taste out of it there. You know, the only reason you stop is because you're too full. You couldn't eat anymore. But if you could eat, you'd keep eating.
My experience is slightly different. Sometimes I'm so hungry, so much in the meditation theater, that you put it in, and the first couple of mouthfuls you don't taste because you're just trying to.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, that's there. Yeah.
Then after a while, you settle down. Then the real taste comes.
Yeah, but then it disappears again. That's the thing, it's transitory. That's the whole problem with the whole process. Is that senses have to be engaged and taken care of, but the point is if that's your purpose, then you don't actually enjoy them. Well, if you're not trying to, then you actually enjoy them, but as soon as you try to enjoy them, you don't enjoy them. So that's the thing, you have to be passive in this. So from the platform of goodness, it's your duty to take prasad, it's your duty to honor, it's your duty to... So then in that duty, you automatically taste, you automatically... Does that make sense? But if you separately endeavor for it, then you won't get. So then you start to see is that it's not really worth it. The balance of what you do, how much austerity is there, and then what you get out of the senses. And then by getting the senses, if you try to enjoy them, it goes into passion or even ignorance. You know, actual endeavor for sense gratification is ignorance. Trying to gain something, that's the passion. You know, but once you're trying to enjoy it, that's ignorance. It drops in. That, the 12th chapter will describe that. Yes. Women don't go further than the mode of passion. I remember someone mentioning that, but I haven't specifically seen it. Because there's the point of gain and safety, right? So the gain then is there's unlimited things to gain. It means there'd be one that's prominent, but what's presently trying to be gained. But as soon as that's gained, immediately there's another one replaces that. You know, there would be the ideas that if I get this, that'll be satisfied. But as soon as that one's got, then the next one immediately rises. And then they have to be protected. Because that's that sense of mind. Then they have to be protected. So by nature, that would be where it would sit. So only by chanting and by trying to detach oneself from the importance of material endeavor, then the mode of goodness and then transcendence can be attained. But on its natural setting, then you'll see the women will tend to be more towards passion. Because they're always gaining. Men may be in passion if they're very involved with women. The less involved, it may be goodness or ignorance. Like that. So you'll generally see the women will always be more passionate because they desire their activity. You'll always see women are active. You don't see lazy women generally. They'll be active for something. But men, you can find lazy men. They won't get active even for sense grab. They not like to do certain work, like housework or this or that. They'd rather be out partying or that. But they have to work to do that. They got to go out. They got to buy clothes. They got to do the makeup. They got to smile. They got to do all. I mean, it's hard work. You know, like that. Well, the men just thinks he just goes as he is, you know, the slob walks in there, you know. Find that men can be situated on any of the three very easily, but the natural default setting for women will be passion because of that desire to gain, you know. Passion, ignorance is then once they get it, they identify with it and then they want to protect it and all these things, so that's ignorance. So that's the thing, is by chanting, by following the process, then one can go beyond that. You know? But that's why it's also important that then the women connect themselves with men who have that situation in goodness of transcendence, because then that will help them control that passion. You know, because if they have a good example of something like that, then when it reduces their own desires, so they're more satisfied, more content. So then their passion will be applied within that sphere of goodness. Because goodness is still has passion and ignorance in it, so it can accommodate the woman's mood within it. Right? So the man is situated in goodness. So there's enough passion and ignorance that he's married to a woman. And then she has her desires, but she, within the mode of goodness, starts picking and choosing. You know what I'm saying? Does that make some sense? It's like within the Brahminical culture that he's following, then she, you know, will pick out, you know, like that, try to get this, try to get that. Or, you know, they have one Achman cup there. It'd be nice if they had one in the next room, more convenient also. Or, you know, they had a nicer spoon than we got. Why can't we get a spoon like that for our Achman cup? Or, you know, they have a plate under their Achman cup that keeps it from dripping on the table and making marks in the varnish. So we need a plate for the Achman. So, but it's been reduced down to an Achman cup, you know, instead of, you know, palaces and gardens and vehicles, you know, like that. So it's still there, but it's been reduced down to a workable amount. So then it's just moving up and down from the middle line, very small. So even though one's situated there in goodness, one gets conditioned to it, so then a small aberration seems to be very big, but it can be easily straightened out with some logic and some support. While lamentation are shut to your women, because they can help them stay in line, or vaishyas, shudras. You know, like shudras, they maybe can't straighten it out, but they also like to lament. So then when the woman gets very lamentated, then they can also get involved in it. They can turn into a whole, you know, how you say, you know, melodrama. You know, they all enjoy the situation, you know. Well, the point is the man, vaishya man, has enough passion to gain, that the wife wants to gain all these things. He doesn't mind trying unlimitedly beyond what he needs. So, you know, within that unlimited, you know, there's a good scope that the woman will get a good percentage of what she wants. You know? Not everything, because those desires go beyond unlimited. You know, so it's just that it balances. That's the whole thing. So if one wants to go beyond this, then one has to keep that sattvic association, the transcendental association. Then that will keep it in line. It's workable. In other words, it'll still drive you nuts, but it's a workable nuttiness, you know. And then with practice in that, that will start to get less, like that, because you have it in control. If something's in control, you can reduce it. So if you're starting with minimal, it's easy to get minimal down to practically nothing. If you're starting with a huge amount, it makes sense. If you start with a 90%, reduce it to 10%, still it's 10%. But if you start with 1% and reduce it down to 0.01, then it's much more workable. Does that make sense? So it's that's the point of knowing the field. Is if one can see that, he'll profess the world that she's not. But that's only for gain and fear of loss. That's all. Defending the feminine nature, you know, in the men's world, because they don't defend it in the women's world, they defend it in the men's world, is that they're afraid of loss, that they won't gain what they want, or they'll lose something they already have, because the men will then, you know, because women are too strange, they won't deal with them. But if there's that trust that that's not going to happen, then there's no problem. But the woman, if she can identify and that herself, she knows the field she's dealing with, then she can actually work with it. She knows that it's inclined towards passion, then understanding what passion is, then she'll learn to control that. Then she'll get the best out of it. She'll be able to engage her conditioned nature the most directly in the Lord's service. Well, if she doesn't, she refuses to understand that, then she doesn't know the field she's dealing with, then she'll be carried overwhelmed by it. Does that make some sense? like that. Because that woman who understands it is immediately reduced. That woman who doesn't, then it stays whatever its natural position is. So that's the thing. As soon as it's understood, same with the men, they have the same, they have their anomalies. So as soon as they recognize them, then it's reduced. But if they don't recognize, then it stays full, and then one will be controlled by it. So it's a matter of, are we controlled by it, or are we in control of it but still work with it? I mean, we don't have another nature. We can't function outside our conditioned nature. Right? It means we can function purely on the transcendental platform if possible. But if not to that degree, if not, we will have to deal with the conditioned nature. So now the choice is, do you want to be controlled by that conditioned nature, or in a controlled way do you want to engage your conditioned nature? That's the choice. But the man can't change it. His body, his mind, his intelligence, his ego is going to work as a man's ego, as a man's gross and subtle body, the woman's as a woman's gross and subtle body. It's just a matter, are you controlled by it, so that all the things that the scriptures say and everybody else says is what you do? Or are you in control of it, so it's there, but the anomalies are reduced to a minimum, and what's good about it, you engage? Does that make sense? So like the women tend to be more religious, right? Because the mind is prominent, so mind is the platform of emotion. Religion is the platform of emotion, of the mind. So they'll have more of a tendency towards that. You find the men will get more into the two ends of the scale. Religion they'll do, but the women, it's a sentiment is accepted, it's done. You don't need the intelligence. If they go and they have a nice religious experience, you don't have to convince them religion's good. But a man, even if he has a nice religious experience, then that's a good thing. Now he wants to check it out to see if it's actually worthwhile. So unless he's intellectually, you know, satisfied, he's not going to take it. Even if the experience is good. Or even the experience is bad, intellectually, if he's convinced, he'll take it. Well, the woman, if the experience is bad, it may be very difficult intellectually to convince her. So therefore, if the attachment side of women, that thing of mind, is engaged in the Lord's service, then very quickly they move forward. But if it's engaged in the material side, like you said, passion, then it's very detrimental for them. Because they'll move the quickest into the material energy. Means if a woman becomes materialistic, she'll become materialistic more quickly than the man. Because once the man's been intellectually convinced, even if he goes for it, he's never fully he can never fully do it. Men, once they've been convinced that enjoying the material energy is useless, even if they bloop and become materialistic, they can never still quite do it. It just doesn't quite work for them. You know? Like that. So if the women go materialistic, they can go very deep very quickly until the experience gets so bad, then they'll turn it around. But if the experience on the spiritual is good, then they'll move forward very quickly. So each has its advantage and disadvantage. So that's why then, knowing the field, one can take the best advantage of it. Does that make some sense? Mm-hmm. Yes? No?
Because, as you said, when we follow the process, somehow these designations change slightly. Although I feel when I chant Gayatri, I'm not at all in the mode of goodness and realize that the mind is very fiery, it's very difficult to stabilize and with the mental meditation.
Mm-hmm. That's why
it's easier to chant with the voice.
Yeah, so then use that. It doesn't matter. Main point is to get it done.
Yeah, but it's like, I wonder how to do it. How to be able to chant Gayatri properly.
Like that? Well, see that you're regular. See that your duties are regular. Just see the cleanliness, the environment in which you chant is clean. You know, the situation, you know, the time is good, all these things. So the closer you can get the situation to goodness, then the better chance that your chanting will be more towards goodness. You know, it'll be less affected by passion. Like that. And if you see that your sadhana and everything is good, then that will give you that spiritual strength. Because you're trying to get from passion through goodness to transcendence. Like that. Because, you know, so therefore you just see that all your situations are in goodness. Then the passion will reduce. The whole idea is reduce it down to where it's workable. And then eventually, by the chanting process and association and knowledge, then it will become practically disappear. That's why Bhagavatam says to practically nil. It doesn't completely go away, because it can't, because it completely disappears and our body disappears. Right? Because the body is a product of the material energy. So it can't completely go away, otherwise it would just be a soul floating around. And, you know. So the body still has to remain, but it will get rid of basically everything. Gross and subtle body will remain, but they will be in such a pure state that they're considered spiritual. They're spiritualized. Like that. So that can be done. But it has to be understood is that that's what you're dealing with. That's why to try to situate oneself in the most pure situation is the best. That's why the purity and the control of the senses are important. But as we see from before, the strongest element in this is the chanting. The thing that's going to give us the greatest success is the chanting. So if you focus on making your chanting good, then your Gayatri will become good. Because the Gayatri is a servant. It's the life of the Gayatri mantras are the holy name. They're called Namatmika. Because the name is their life. Without the name, then they're not. So to that degree that you chant well, to that degree the Gayatris will go well. Brahma Gayatri, no. Pancharatrik, yes. But the Pancharatrik Gayatris are different because they will be considered as coming from the Veda. But the Brahma Gayatri wasn't. Because somehow or another there's an element of the Purusha Bhava in it. So it's in one sense incompatible with a purified feminine nature. The two don't go together well. But in this day and age, the women have been so much pushed towards the Purusha mood themselves that the men use it to dissolve the masculine identity. That's the purpose of it. So the women wouldn't have that. They would have it, that controlling attitude, but from the feminine point of view. And now much of it's been increased to the point where it may be of advantage for them also. So it's not a problem if that's seen from that angle. It's for removing the Purusha Bhav. So if once it's removed the masculinity on the male-female principle, on the external, let's say, on the social principle goes away, they can still use it to advantage on the subtle. Of trying to control and enjoy. If they don't do that, then they'll have problem. Then it may be disturbing. You know, it may kind of increase that mood. But if they see it like that, then it won't. It'll just go straight through. Gaudiya Math doesn't do. In the beginning, probably wasn't planning to. Like that. What Jimmy was telling me is that probably the first initiation where he gave second initiation, then he gave to the men, but didn't give to the women, the Brahma Gayatri. He gave the other Gayatris, but he didn't give the Brahma. And then I think there were 10 ladies, they all went on strike, they wouldn't come to the temple, they wouldn't do anything. Yeah. So then after a while, the Prabhupada says, okay. It's unfortunate. But since it's been authorized to the Acharya, then there's nothing wrong with it. Because he's looking at it from the point is that's not the feminine attitude. Right? The feminine attitude might be a little bit fiery, it's the left wing there, but it wouldn't be that extreme. Because it was displeasing to the male that they were taking shelter of, they wouldn't take it to that extreme. Generally, unless extreme cases, you see that in. We only see that in all of the histories in Jagannanda Pandit. you know, Satyabhama. So there's one example, only one example, where the left wing is taken to such extremity. But there's such attachment there. So the attachment balances. But in this case, it appeared that the attachment wasn't as strong. It was just complete, you know, they didn't care. You know, because otherwise you can tell, there'll be that left wing will be so powerful, and they'll be so, you know, kind of like self-centered and demanding and these kind of things. But if the other person has any something goes wrong, then immediately then they come back on that. You know? So that's the thing, is because the attachment to the other person is so great, it immediately swings back if that element's brought out. So for Krishna, he knows how to swing it. But otherwise, in the material world, the left wing isn't taken as the ideal. The right wing is always taken, at least socially. It means in the house, privately, the woman may have a left wing mood. But public dealings, or also any formal dealings, or the house dealings with the family and all, that's always right wing. That's always what's recognized. You don't see it outside of that. It's considered bad. Like that. So you see.
Does that make sense? Because the point is left wing means the attachment is greater. So if the attachment's on Krishna, then it's fine. So when the left wing is directed at Krishna, it's fine. But in the material world, the left wing is directed at themselves, so it's not progressive. If it's directed at Krishna, then it becomes nice. Or sometimes it's directed at the person, at some man, but then that's because he takes care. You know, so then in their consciousness and in the dealings and everything, it's actually the attachment to the man. But underlying it is because the man is their support. You remove that support, then they'll lose. So therefore that's why they're so attached. And it's just like, let's say somebody gives you, you know, $1 million every year, you know, you'd be very attached to them. Losing them, you would feel, there's the thing that they're giving you, that if you're pious, then you appreciate the giving, the exchange and all that. But the underlying it is the reason that that's there is because they're giving you something. Does that make sense? So that's why in the material platform, if you dismantle the mentalities that are going on in the material world and relationships, it gets kind of mercenary. So that's why you focus on the duties. And only if you want to break off attachment in the material world do you then get into this. For the purpose of liberation, then you dismantle it. But in the operating of relationships, you don't bother. You just look at the performance of duty. Then that makes them work very nicely. Because you go by what's conscious, the conscious endeavor. The unconscious, then that's another. If the conscious is purified and in good association, the unconscious will start to follow. So if one performs one's duties properly in Krishna consciousness, then all the unconscious things underlying will go away. Does that make sense? So only for the purpose of the individual's introspection and for breaking the attachment to the material energy, then you get into these things where you break it down and you actually see how it looks this way, but it switches that way in this, you know, like that. Does that make sense? Okay, so then the whole point in this is that you can gain whatever you want to gain by sense control only. Right? There's a chapter later. By austerity only is anything gained. There's no gain in anything. And austerity can only be performed if there's sense control. Like that. So the success of anything, sense, Dharma Shastra means for success, right? Dharma means you get artha. So success is gained by sense control. So we don't operate the Dharma for artha. We operate the Dharma that its result will be moksha instead of artha, because we want bhakti. So on the mundane platform, from the Dharma, then the result is
is liberation that brings us to the Brahma-Buddha platform. So that's why simultaneously one performs devotional activities along with the culture. And the culture, one engages also in bhakti. So bhakti becomes the overarching activity in everything in the life. And some things are direct spiritual activities, some are dovetailed. But in any case, pleasing the Lord, bhakti becomes the common ground. Because artha automatically comes. If you have dharma, artha automatically comes. But if it's done with knowledge, then moksha comes also. Right? But if it's not done with knowledge, then you only get artha. Right? And then that artha, because you don't have knowledge, is ignorance, means you go for kama. Right? Because kama is ignorance. If it's done with knowledge, you go for moksha, and you won't, artha is there, you'll also use that for furtherance of performance of religious duties for liberation. Does that make sense? That's the material operating of the system. Right, mechanics of it. Though our purpose is bhakti, so we're not interested in liberation either. Just liberation means we're not connected with the material world. So for us, the less we're connected with the material world, then the more we can connect ourselves with Krishna. Because if our heart is full of material desire, then we can't stick Krishna in there. We remove the material desire, we can put Krishna in there. Right? It's just a matter of volume. You know, if you have a cup, it probably gives the example, you have a cup full of ink. Then there's no space to put any milk inside. And even if you pour the milk into the ink, still the milk becomes contaminated by the ink. So you have to take the ink, throw it out, then you can fill up the cup.
I heard an example of the ink, you keep pouring and that will come out and milk instead.
Yeah, but you have to pour for a long time. It's just like this, is that you'd probably have to pour gallons, you know, of milk like that, and to whether it's there. But if you take the cup, throw it out, rinse it out, and then put it back. You only need one cup of milk to make it full. So that's a waste. So that's the whole point, is that's why you put in the endeavor to remove the material desire. Is that...
We need Krishna to replace, because there's always a desire for enjoyment, it's
inherent
to the soul.
Yeah. So that's why it's done simultaneously. That's why it's never forget Krishna, always remember Krishna. The two go together. It's one rule. It's the two parts of the rule. So we simultaneously, that's why bhakti has to be there for the whole thing. Because that's what's making me step. Because if you control the senses, then if Krishna's there, it can be done. Like that. You know? Just like that, it's natural if you have affection for someone you like to serve. So you'll go to all kinds of austerity and difficulty to please that person. So automatically, if Krishna is there, then sense control then it becomes part of the process. Because you want to please Him. You know, that's the point. So then sense control doesn't become a separate activity. You know, it's just part of the affection for Krishna. Well, if you try to just control the senses, do this and that, and then when it's all perfect, then put the Lord in there. That's the system we see of yoga. Is Krishna doesn't start on the process until dhyan. That means the sixth level, the seventh level. So you have to go through six levels without any juice at all. And finally, the seventh level, Krishna comes into it. So that's the difficulty. That's why in the Ashtanga Yoga system, then for the first six, we have our own methods. We don't use their system. So, but the seventh and eighth platform, what we do and what they do is the same, is common. Because that's actually the platform of bhakti. So that's why in the Gita, then it's talking about that higher, is it yoga rurukshu? Yoga rudha and yoga rurukshu, which is the higher? I always can never remember.
Yoga Rudha.
Is the higher. Okay, so Yoga Rudha means the first six levels. So we have our own method for what's favorable, what's not favorable. You know, how to situate ourselves, how to control, you know, our activities, right? How to then therefore control the senses and how to focus. Right? So that's your sixth level. So we have our own methods for that, which are not mechanical, but it's, we do it by engaging the Lord's service. So we accept those things that are good for the service, reject those things that are not. We situate ourselves in a situation that is spiritual, you know, with devotees in the temple, you know, things that are favorable in the house. So that's our asana. Right, that then pranayama means your life airs are your activity. So we do activities that are connected to Krishna. Right, they just control the breath. So they reduce it down very small. There's only asana means their body and where they're sitting, rather than the whole situation. Still, they have to they under this tree or that or this. So they have to do it, but that's the focus is narrow. Well, for us, it's broad. So we situate ourselves where it's good, that's our asana. We engage the energies in the Lord's service, that's our pranayama. Right? Pratyahara means we pull in the senses by focusing on Krishna. Right? Like that. And then dharana, then we focus on Krishna. So therefore, means we already have Krishna. We start, dharana for us is fair, but they're doing dharana focusing without Krishna. It's just focusing the mind. That's why Arjuna rejects it. He says this is practically impossible. And he's in Dwapara Yuga. So it's only possible in the Satya Yuga. They had such focus that they could sit down and just through meditation do it. So even the women could do it. Right? You see husband and wife would go out and do yogic meditation, then when they'd see the super soul, then they would take his permission, then they would go back and then have children and have a family. So in that age, the focus was such that they could do it. But in these age, no. You know, it means Dwapara Yuga wasn't possible, let alone now. You know. So that's the thing. No, in the... Yeah. Huh? Dharana is jnana. Then when dharana, once it's focused, then you put Krishna there as the meditation. But for us, Krishna is the meditation for why we accept things or reject things or are judging the situation, the asana, the situation that we're in. Is it good for devotional service? What is the best? Like that. Our activities are for Krishna. Our sense control is, then Krishna is there because it pleases his senses to do this. So that we will engage our senses in his service. Right? So in other words, you're engaging your situation in the Lord's service as asana, you're engaging your activities in the Lord's service as pranayama, you're engaging your focus. No, but pratyahara was engaging our senses in the Lord's service as pratyahara, and we're engaging the mind in the Lord's service, you know, the focusing on him as dharana. So then dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, then all, it's just all the mind. Does that make sense? So that's how our system works. So you can see is that yoga has just taken the principal element of the bhakti but reduced it down to a mechanical process and something that one person can do on their own. You know? Like that. Without association. Like that. Well, the devotees can do it alone if there is no association, but the best is they have association. And it expands.
Sadhus
are always. Yogis, you generally see them on their own. Sometimes they'll come together. Like I remember that some, I think it was the 77, yeah, when Prabhupada went to Kumbh Mela, that the devotees were walking with Prabhupada. Because you walk around, you know, you go see all the sadhus. You know, go around and see, you know, what's there. Who's there? Prabhupada pointed to one group. It was a small group. I think someone told me it was like five or six yogis, long, long matted hair, and they looked very, very young. Prabhupada pointed. They said that they're hundreds of years old. Says they come down to they come down for the, you know, for these programs, and then go back. And he says, these are these ones. He says, the more powerful ones don't even bother. They just dip into the Ganga at the top, you know, up at, you know, wherever they are up in the Himalayas there, you know, if you know, what is it, those places, you know, Deva Prayag and all those places up there. And then they just come in underground and then come up at the Sangam, take their bath, go down and they go back. They don't even bother to come and hang out. You know? But I remember one devotee telling me he saw this on Prabhupada's picture. So it's just because they stop the breathing. So you're allotted a certain amount of breaths. So then if you stop the breathing, then you extend the life. That's all. You know, it's a simple thing. I mean, simple means that the principle is simple. The endeavors are not as simple. So you have to put the inner breath into the outer breath, you know. That's where they have that asana, there's a lotus asana, where you reach around behind, you cross your hands behind your back and you grab your toes, big toe, because it keeps you straight. That's for when you first start up doing the advanced levels of pranayama, where you try to stop the breathing. Because in the beginning, the body quakes so heavily that you'll fall over in any other asana and they get hurt. So that asana keeps them sitting up so they don't fall over and hurt themselves. You know, until they get it where the inner and the outer air become peaceful and just blend in. Otherwise they fight and you want to breathe, you know. But they get it where just everything relaxes. So that's what that asana's for. You know, because otherwise it's not a comfortable asana for meditation. It's just for use of pranayama. You know? Okay. Okay. So then, here this last part, let an Aryan who has been initiated daily offer fuel in the sacred fire, beg food, sleep on the ground, and do what is beneficial to his teacher until he performs the ceremony of Samvartana, returning home. Means that's graduation. So until he graduates, then he should do these things. Right? He should perform sacrifice, he should beg, that keeps him humble. He should sleep on the ground, means he should control his senses, not keep paraphernalia and things like that. Sleeping on the ground means without a bed. Right? When the Shastra says sleeping on the ground, that doesn't mean directly on the dirt or the stone. That's mentioned as sleeping on stone. That means without any paraphernalia. But this means that your bedding, you put down your mat or your rug or your deerskin or whatever it is on the floor, sleep on that. You don't have a bed. You don't have, you know, wooden thing with legs and mattresses and pillows like that. That's the meaning of sleeping on the ground. So we see is that Brahmins generally sleep on the ground anyway, but that means if they're married they don't have to. But yeah, it's on the ground. It means it's without a bed because it's not as comfortable because the bed gets it up, it's more flexible, you put bigger, so it's just more. You know, it's just like the grihastha doing chaturmash and sleep on the ground. Even though they have a bed, if they're practicing chaturmash, they'll just sleep on the mat on the floor. It doesn't mean you're uncomfortable. You know, it means you can put enough stuff on the floor that it doesn't hurt. But the point is, it's there. But the vrata of chaturmash, where it says sleep on stone, means you sleep directly on the floor, whatever it is. You know, if it's a mud floor, you sleep directly on the mud floor. If it's a stone floor, you sleep directly on the stone floor. That's a different vrata. Like that. Just like eating uncooked food doesn't mean eating raw food. It means eating food that's not cooked in ghee. Like you boil rice, that's uncooked, or boiled dal, then afterwards you put a chaat, you cook a chapati and afterwards put ghee. Right? Or you steam a sabji and afterwards put some ghee on it. That's all uncooked. Raw is separate from that. Raw means that you don't subject it to fire. But the difference between cooked and uncooked food in the Vedic conception is cooked means it's subjected to fire in ghee. So it's cooked with ghee. You make a chaat, put in the vegetables, cook it. That's pukka. If you, let's say, like you take a sabji, you steam it and then put in a chaat at the end, that's uncooked. Like that, because it hasn't been cooked with the ghee. Like that. So it's easier to digest. So kacha food is easier to digest than pukka. Like that. So you'll generally see is that, you know, in the Indian traditions, is the tendency will be more towards the kacha on the daily eating. And then special occasions or weekends or guests and like that, then they'll always do the cooked food. Or if they do the cook, they'll do it more light cooked, and, you know, rather than more heavy. It means like you make a chaunce and then put in your vegetables and then steam it. That'll be lighter than if you stir fry it and then steam it, which would be lighter than if you use a lot of ghee and fry it and then only have to lightly steam it, because it's that, which would be lighter than if you deep fry it and then prepare it. You know, so each, depending on how cooked it is, then it gets heavier and heavier. And so that's how you gauge the cook. So here also, then the principle of sleeping on the ground means that you're sleeping, you're taking your bedding and putting it straight on the ground rather than putting it on a bed that's off the ground. Yeah. How do you? Begging food. Begging food is for the principle of creating humility. So through other menial services. So that makes there. So we can see here is begging food is kind of like is the essential element of like menial service. Collecting what is necessary, begging this and that. So it's all the menial service. So by saying the one, it gets everything. Like offer fuel in the sacred fire. It doesn't say there, it doesn't say Gayatri. So oh, you don't have to chant Gayatri. But it means all that. You know? That's why at the beginning it said that to teach the Brahmacharis that. Yeah. Personal purification, conduct, fire worship, and then twilight devotion. So because within the fire worship, the twilight devotions are important because you do it with your mantras and that. Therefore, it gets its own thing, but it's a secondary aspect on one level because it just means the performance of sacrifice. So in this age, the performance of sacrifice is the holy name. So that becomes more prominent. In the other ages, the sacrifice is more prominent. And then the chanting will be secondary. Though it's a hidden point here, is that no matter what the age, the chanting is actually still the more powerful. Of all the processes, chanting the holy name is the most powerful. But it's hidden in the other ages. So someone could attain perfection through it, but generally they don't. Or they use it in combination, like Dhruva Maharaj, like that. He chanted the holy name and did his yoga meditation. So therefore it was so powerful. In 6 months he completed it. Like that. If you only meditate without the chanting, maybe very slow. Like that.
Is it also for the purpose of learning social etiquette?
Yeah, you learn that. The main thing is it creates humility. Because to beg, you have to be humble. Like that. Beg, you have to be humble. So it's all that. Same time as do what is beneficial, the teacher means he has to have a service attitude. So you have your humble, submissive service attitude, controlling the senses and engaged in spiritual activities. That basically summarizes Brahmacharya life. Because doing what is beneficial to the teacher means you have to respect the teacher. Therefore, then you see the next topic is respectful behavior towards gurus. So this is basically, that one's a summary of the first one of that other, and this one then it like summarizes the Brahmacharya Ashram. So any other questions? See, paka food means because it's been cooked in the ghee, it's purified by the ghee. So that which is uncooked then carries more karma because it hasn't been purified by that ghee. In other words, the uncooked carries the karma, the cooked carries only the consciousness. But now raw food means uncooked, means this hasn't been in any way subjected to the fire. You know, just raw ingredients. That then would carry the minimum. So that's why it's suggested that if you're taking food from persons who are virtuous or that, you can eat their food. But if you have to beg from those who are not, then better to get raw ingredients and cook it yourself. You know, that's always the better option. That's also discussed later in purity. That makes sense? Anything else?
Because you described six levels of yoga, which are called Yoga Rudra.
Yeah, Yoga Rudra.
So could you kind of explain level of Yoga Rukshu?
Yoga Rukshu is the dhyana and samadhi.
Mm-hmm.
So that for us is the same. It's still the absorption and then attainment of samadhi. So that has five levels.
Mm-hmm.
Means I don't remember them all, but you have smriti, anusmriti, you know, samadhi, like this. So they're all these things. So dhyan means that you've started meditating on the Lord. When it's focused, that's all you're meditating on. Then that has five levels. So in the platform of Bhava Bhakti, the same aspects are gone through. So when it comes that Krishna is always your meditation, then it comes to that platform of dhyan. Then that has to come to the platform of samadhi. When it comes to samadhi, then you're qualified then to always associate with Krishna. Because before that, then you're not, because other things will keep you happy. So then why Krishna would be there if you have other things to keep you happy?
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? Yes, that's why it says the fool and the Paramahamsa are happy. Everybody in the middle suffers. That's basically the platform of that neutrality. So that would be, what do you call it? Nishta would be like that. Service is stable and all that. You have no taste for the material, but the taste for the holy name hasn't really become fully established. So when the taste comes, because there's no attachment to the material, when the taste does come, then it becomes very dynamic, because then you move forward very fast. So then one should endeavor to try to always absorb oneself in the name, associating with those who have a taste for the name. You know, kirtan, hearing, you know, studying, like this. Those things that are connected with Krishna, worshipping the Dham, the five main elements, appreciating the Dham. Do those things that are connected with that, because that then will bring you very quickly to the platform of Ruchi. And then once you get to Ruchi, then it's basically, it moves very fast. Because once you have the higher taste, all the lower taste goes away. So then all the subtle aspects of distinction, adoration, and profit go away. Like that. Because as long as this subtle is there, there's always the fear that it will turn into gross. So generally in Nishta, the gross is given up. But distinction, adoration, and profit may still remain. So at Ruchi, then that goes also. So then one advances very quickly. So then from Ruchi comes attachment very soon. Then from attachment, bottom. But until you get to Ruchi, then it'll be slow. You know? But it means until you get to Nishta, it's even slower. Nishta, things speed up. There, because then the chanting comes to the offenseless stage. So in the offenseless stage, you're not doing anything that's going to make any problem for it. But still, it has to come to the Shuddhanam. So when you have a taste, then that's where Shuddhanam comes. Is that okay? Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada.